Kaj? Kako? Zmeneta teroristična. Še vi črnava blasfemična. Mi spanec kratite, zvonov milozvočje dušite.
Zgodovine iz božjih ust preko obličja frekvence 89,3 v vaša ušesa. Vsak prvi četrtek opoldne.
Bilo bi zanimivo danes videti izraz na licu prvaka laissez-faire kapitalizma Miltona Friedmana, Nobelovca za ekonomijo, letnik 76, med drugim tudi svetovalca Ronalda Reagana. In to kljub temu, da je svoje čase javno podpiral nekatere prijeme Rooseveltovega New Deala, ter kljub temu, da je kvečemu pohvalno vsej svoji liberalistični ihti zagovarjal tudi legalizacijo prostitucije in trave. Zanimivo bi ga bilo videti in slišati njegove komentarje na popolno zblaznelost emancipiranega kapitala v 21. stoletju, ki bo 15. oktobra na ulici svetovnih mest po zgledu trenutnih dogodkov na Wall Streetu popeljala okupatorje oziroma osvoboditelje. Milton Friedman je od novembra 26 pokojen, zato zadnje krize ni dočakal. Zato nanj pri iskanju raznorodnih in raznovrstnih postkapitalističnih alternativ pač ne gre računati. V množicah tistih, ki jih med New Yorkom, Ljubljano, Kinshaso in Tokijom iščejo in so pri tem relativno uspešni, najdemo Thomasa Friedmana, dolgoletni zunanji politični poročevalc in kolumnist New Yorkskega Timesa, trikratni Pulitzerjev nagrajenec in pisec kopice knjig, vse po vrsti visokonakladnice in visokoprodajnice, vse po vrsti navidez lahkotni pozivi k premisleku, ki pa mu New York, Ljubljana, Kinshasa in Tokio vsaj prisluhnejo. Zadnja je v sodelovanju z Michaelom Mandelbaumom izšla pred kratkim. That used to be us, how America fell behind in the world it invented and how we can come back. Oziroma, če prevedemo, to smo bili mi, kako je Amerika zaostala v svetu, ki ga je izumla in kako se lahko poberemo. Njen amerocentrizem avtorja vnaprej upravičujeta z generativno funkcijo, ki jih ZDA kot glavne potrošnice približno vsega imajo. In če ima pomankanje zaupanja v Indice, Kitajce, Brazilce in druge pretendente za vodilni generativni položaj odpustimo, omenjenih namreč nikakor ne podcenjujeta, prej občudujeta, je branje najnovejše izdaje poštena brca. In to ne v rit, ampak v možgane. Profitiramo pa itak vsi. Okupatorji Wall Streeta lahko svoj prav potrdijo, opazovalci in nasprotniki okupatorjev Wall Streeta pa lahko svojega še enkrat premislijo. Razen, če mislijo, da je svet, kot ga poznamo, trenutno in dolgoročno ok. Thomas Friedman pred nekaj dnevi.
If I were to ask, you know, what are our key problems, and that's really where the rest of the first half of this book goes, I would say it starts, first of all, with what to me is the most disturbing thing that goes on in this country every day. We do not start our day at the political level by asking, to me, the most fundamental question: what world are we living in? What world are we living in, and what are the biggest trends in that world? We start our day with our two political parties basically taking out a crowbar and saying, how do I stick this in the wheel of the other party, okay, so I can win this news cycle? That's how we start our day. One of my favorite quotes in the book is from a Singaporean economist who said to me, Tom, you don't understand, we in Singapore, we live in a thatched hut with no doors and no windows. We feel every change of breeze. We feel every change of temperature. You Americans, you think you're still living in a brick house with central heating. You feel nothing, but the walls are cracking, and the water is seeping in from the roof. There's a concept in the Air Force which we quote, it's called the OODA loop, O-O-D-A. It's used by Air Force fighter pilots in dogfights. OODA stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, Act. And they have a simple rule in the Air Force among fighter pilots. If your OODA loop is faster than the other fighter pilots, you will shoot him or her out of the sky. If her OODA loop or his OODA loop is faster than yours, you are a dead man. Right now, our OODA loop, our ability to observe, orient, decide, and act as a country is completely discombobulated. Now, I would argue that the crisis we are in right now is not rooted in 2008. We are not in a two-year, three-year hole. Our crisis today is the product of two fundamental errors that go back 20 years. The first is that we did something, the most dangerous thing a country or species can do, we misread our environment. We thought the end of the Cold War was a victory. It was a victory. But we thought it was a victory that allowed us and enabled us to put our feet up and relax. It was a victory that unleashed and liberated 2 billion people just like us, who wanted to compete, collaborate, and connect. And just when we needed to be lacing up our shoes and redoubling our pace, we put our feet up. Then we compounded that problem. We compounded it after 9/11 by spending a decade chasing the losers from globalization called Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, rather than the winners called India, China, Brazil, and all the others. And so we are in a 20-year hole. In this 20-year hole, we have gotten away from our formula for success. We didn't get here by accident, and the panelists alluded to it. We became a great country because we had a formula for success. It goes back to Hamilton and Lincoln. It was built on five pillars: education, educating your people up to and beyond whatever the technology is. Infrastructure, have the world's best infrastructure. Immigration, be open to the world's most energetic and talented entrepreneurs. Rules for capital investing, have the right rules to attract capital, and lastly, government-funded research to push out the boundaries of science. You look at all five of those today, and the arrow is pointing down on all five. We have completely become disconnected from the greatest public-private partnership in the history of the world, and we are not talking about it. Now, why do we need to revive that great public-private partnership? Because we face today three critical challenges, and I'm just going to talk in detail about the first. The first is the challenge posed by the merger of globalization and the IT revolution. It was alluded to on this panel, and it's what's driving so much change. The second is entitlements and the whole deficit question, and the third is energy and climate. How do we grow in a growing world without tipping our planet into dangerous climate change? So let me spend the rest of my time focusing on this first challenge that we face, because it's one I think you all face. How do we manage the merger of globalization and the IT revolution, which ultimately is an education challenge? Now, as some of you know, in 2004, I wrote a book called The World is Flat. I declared the world had gotten connected. The world is flat. And when we sat down to write this book, I called my co-author one day, Michael, and I said, you know, Mike, it's interesting. I just went back to the first edition of The World is Flat, which I started writing in 2004, came out in 2005. I looked in the index under F. Facebook wasn't in it. So when I wrote The World, when I said, the world is flat, we're all connected. Facebook didn't exist. Twitter was a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking place. LinkedIn was a prison. Applications were what you sent to college. And for most people, Skype was a typo. Okay? That's... none of that existed when I was out there telling people the world is flat. All of that came in the next 6 years. So we're not just in Flat World 1.0, we're in 2.0. We've gone from a connected world to a hyper-connected world. So when I wrote The World is Flat, I said we connected Boston and Bangalore in India. The world is flat. Well, now we've connected Boston, Bangalore, and Sirisi. You say, where's Sirisi? Sirisi's a town 90 miles to the interior with 90,000 people, which, thanks to the internet and smartphones, is right on the grid now with your kids in mind. When I wrote The World is Flat, I said we connected Detroit and Damascus. Well, now we've connected Detroit, Damascus, and Dara. Say, where's Dara? Dara's the dusty Syrian border town on the Syrian-Jordanian border where the uprising there began, which thanks to flip cams and cell phone video and pictures and texting has been driving the Syrian revolution from Dara on the Syrian-Jordanian border. So we've gone from a world that is connected to hyper-connected, and it is changing everything, but because it has happened under the mask and noise of the subprime crisis, and in America, the war on terrorism, we have not been talking about it. One of my favorite quotes, I was traveling in India in 2010 and picked up the Hindustan Times one day. I'll just give you a couple examples of hyperconnectivity. And there was a story there that caught my eye. It said that a Nepali telecommunications firm had just started providing 3G mobile network service at the summit of Mount Everest, the world's tallest mountain. The story said this would allow thousands of climbers and trekkers who throng the region every year to access high-speed internet and video calls using their mobile phone from the top of the world's tallest mountain. Can you imagine the number of calls being made from there that begin, "Mom, you'll never guess where I'm calling you from." Okay. Another small item in the paper that underscores this connectivity and what it means is hyperconnectivity. Small college out in Iowa, Grinnell College, 1,600 students, great liberal arts college. My mother-in-law went to school there, was later chairman of the board. Small item in the New York Times a couple months ago said that this year at Grinnell College, 10% of the applications came from China. Of those 10%, 50% had perfect 800s on their math SATs. So what does this hyperconnectivity mean for us and for all of you? What it means is that the global curve is rising. The global curve is rising. If the world were a classroom being graded on a curve, curve just went up. Because every one of the CEOs in this room now, thanks to hyperconnectivity, has access to more cheap automation, cheap software, hugely productive software, robotics, and not just cheap labor, but cheap genius than ever before. And the implications of this for the workplace and then for education are going to be enormous. And let me just go through a few of them. What all of this is doing to the workplace, to put it in the jargon of labor economics, is that it is really driving skills bias polarization. Skills bias polarization says people who have these skills to compete globally will do better than ever, and those who don't have a high school degree or even a college degree now, there will increasingly be, in this hyper-connected world, nothing for them. Now, traditionally, the way labor economists talked about the workforce was that you kind of have three categories. You have non-routine workers, scientists, engineers, lawyers, doctors, artists, hopefully journalists, okay? And CEOs and business consultants. Then you had routine workers, and then you had non-routine local workers, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. And their wages would depend on the health of your local economy. What's basically happened are two things, not one. The one everyone has observed as the routine work has collapsed. Anything that can be described by an algorithm now, that work is disappearing. You have to be doing non-routine work. But here's what's really interesting, exciting, and terrifying. It's not enough anymore to just say, I'm non-routine. I'm a lawyer. I'm an accountant. I'm an engineer. Now you have to be a creative non-routine worker. And it's not enough to say I'm a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker. Now you have to be a creative butcher, baker, and candlestick maker. Everyone has to bring something extra to this world because, as one of the chapters of our book declares, average is now officially over. Average in a hyper-connected world is over. There's an old saying in Texas, if all you ever do is all you've ever done, all you'll ever get is all you've ever got. That is no longer applicable. If all you ever do is all you've ever done, all you'll ever get in a hyper-connected world is less than you've ever got, because your boss now is asking himself or herself every day, what is your unique value contribution? And if you cannot justify it in this world, I have a machine, a piece of software, cheap genius or cheap labor, who can? So what we did in this book, and the reason, the way I discovered this was, we wanted to talk about education, but I thought, well, before we talk about education, maybe we should actually go to employers and ask them, what are you looking for? What are you looking for by employee? So we went to four generic employers: high-end white collar, the head of a Washington law firm, national firm; low-end white collar, the head of an outsourcing firm in India; blue collar, the head of DuPont, Ellen Cullman; and lastly, green collar, the world's biggest green collar company in the world, the U.S. Army. Here's what we found, and it was fascinating. They're all looking for the same employee. What's that employee they're looking for? They're looking for an employee who can do critical thinking and reasoning and problem solving, ... in order to get an interview. Oh yeah, critical reasoning and thinking? That's now table stakes for all these companies. Because what they're really looking for are people who can invent, reinvent, and re-engineer their job while they're doing it. Because when the world gets this hyper-connected, Sam Palmisano, one of our premier CEOs, he can't possibly know what's going on down there. Nobody can. And if he doesn't have people on the line who can invent, re-engineer, and reinvent their job while they're doing it, that bottom up, and then he can edit it and inspire and enable it, there's no way he can survive. There are companies in Silicon Valley now that have gone to reviewing their employees or team leaders quarterly. Because if you have five product cycles in a year now, you can't wait till the end of the year to discover you have a bad team leader. And I know what you're thinking. Very easy for you to say, Mr. New York Times columnist. You have nothing to worry about. No, 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 you don't get it. You see, I inherited James Reston's office at the New York Times, a great New York Times columnist and editor from the 1960s and 70s. Now, I suspect that Mr. Reston used to come to the office every day and ask himself back in the 60s, I wonder what my seven competitors are going to write today. And he actually knew all seven. Walter Lippmann, Stuart Alsop, Mary McGrory. I do the same thing. I come to the office every day and I say, I wonder what my 70 million competitors are going to write today. Because if I'm going to write about India, well, I better write about it better than the best Indian blogger in the Hindustan Times, because you can now go to realclearpolitics.com, click on Real Clear World, and read him or her right next to my column this morning. And don't think I am not aware of that. So I'm running faster than ever. So the way I got into this, or onto this theme, was goes back to the subprime crisis. The head of this Washington law firm, Nixon Peabody, Jeff Lesk is his name, happens to be the husband of my wife's best friend. And I asked him in 2008, the height of the subprime, I said, Jeff, what does this do to a law firm? He said, business is way off. I said, well, that's interesting. In a law firm, in a partnership, what happens? He said, we're laying people off. I said, who gets laid off first in a law firm? We said, it's kind of different now. The people who are being laid off are those who, in the bubble, we had a lot of legal work. We took that legal work. We gave it to them. They did it in a very, you know, non-routine way, but in a very average non-routine way, and gave it back. They're gone. We can't afford them anymore. The ones we're keeping are those who came to us and said, you know, Jeff, we could do this old work in a new way. Or we could do new work in a new way. I'm an old fuddy-duddy. I'm 58 years old. I got to find a job when I graduated from college. Your kids and mine will have to invent a job more and more when they graduate from college if they want to get a job at Jeff Lesk's firm. Now, his interview in the book begins very simply. The head of this Washington law firm says, we just hired a chief innovation officer. Yeah, his law firm just hired a chief innovation officer. Because if they can't keep up with the rapid change of commoditization of legal services by inventing new ones, they're gone. Now, maybe the most interesting interview was with the head of that green collar firm, the U.S. Army. His name is General Martin Dempsey. Now, it's a name you may have heard of if you followed American military affairs over the last decade, because General Dempsey is about to become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. When we interviewed him, though, he was head of the U.S. Army Education Corps. But before he did that, he had two interesting jobs. In 2003, he commanded the U.S. troops that took Baghdad from Saddam Hussein. He commanded the 1st Armored Division. 5 years later, he became head of CENTCOM, our military command. And this is a story he tells us in the book. In 2008, as the head of CENTCOM, he went to visit a far-flung U.S. base in Afghanistan up near the Hindu Kush, commanded by a captain. He sat down with that captain for an hour, and after the hour, he realized that that captain had at his fingertips access to more intelligence at both the tactical and national level, and more firepower at both the tactical and statewide level than he, Martin Dempsey, had when he took Baghdad from Saddam Hussein in 2003. That's a hyper-connected world. So he took that insight and he went back and said, that means we have to train that captain and choose that captain totally differently than before. And he translated that into a revolution in training in the U.S. Army, where you now go to boot camp. One of the first things you get when you arrive at boot camp in the U.S. Army is an iPhone. And within 2 weeks, you may well be asked to download an app by your drill instructor and teach the course while he sits in the front row. They have completely revolutionized education in the U.S. Army because they don't need people who can just give orders and take orders. They need people who can invent, reinvent, and re-engineer their job. Three pieces of advice which I'll leave you with for, well, what this means basically for education is the following. I just say this. We have two education challenges today. We need to bring the bottom to the average so much faster. We have so many people in our country who are below average. We need to bring that bottom to the average so much faster, because if you are below average now, there is nothing for you that will sustain a middle class lifestyle. Sam's originally from Baltimore. 50 years ago, when he was growing up, the biggest company in Baltimore was called Bethlehem Steel. Today, the biggest company in Baltimore is called John, and by the way, at Bethlehem Steel, you could get a job with a high school degree, earn a good living, buy a house, get a mortgage, have two kids, a dog, and a yard, and retire on a nice pension. Today, the biggest employer in Baltimore is called Johns Hopkins University Medical Center. They don't let you cut the grass there without a BA, okay? So we need to bring the bottom to the average so much faster, but we need to bring the average to the global heights so much faster, because we need so many more creative, non-routine people. And that means we need more education and we need better education. Better education that focuses on the three C's: creativity, communication, and collaboration. My quick summary and message to all of you as parents and educators is the following. This is my distilled advice. If you want to get people in the mindset to compete in this hyper-connected world, get your kids, first of all, to think like new immigrants. Get them, second of all, to think like artisans. And get them, third of all, to think like a waitress at Perkins Pancake House on Highway 100 in Minneapolis. Let me explain. First of all, get your kids to think like a new immigrant. We are all new immigrants today, friends. We are new immigrants to a hyper-connected world. And how does the new immigrant think? He or she starts every day and says, nothing is owed me. Nothing is owed me in this world. There is no legacy place waiting for me at IBM or Harvard or my state university. I better figure out what world I'm in, understand where the opportunities are, and work absolutely harder than the next guy. I am a new immigrant and nothing is owed me here. We are all new immigrants. Second of all, think like an artisan. This is an idea from Professor Lawrence Katz at Harvard. And what Larry argues basically, who is the artisan? The artisan was the person in the Middle Ages, before mass manufacturing and mass production, who made everything one-off. They made every pair of shoes individually. They made every saddle individually. They made every utensil or tool individually. And artisans often took such pride in their work, they brought such extra to what they did, that they carved their initials into them. Whatever job you do today, you should be asking yourself at end of every day, would I want to carve my initials into what I did? Did I bring something extra to this task? And lastly, because we all can't be artisans of software, we all can't be artisans of medicine, think like a waitress at Perkins Pancake House in Minneapolis. I'm from Minneapolis. I was home last summer. summer before, excuse me, working on this book, I had breakfast at Perkins Pancake House with my best friend, Ken Greer, 7 a.m. I ordered 3 buttermilk pancakes and scrambled eggs. He ordered 3 buttermilk pancakes and fruit. And the waitress came after 15 minutes and she put our 2 plates down and all she said was to Ken, I gave you extra fruit. She got a 50% tip from us. Because that waitress, God bless her, she didn't control much, but she controlled the fruit ladle. And that was her extra, okay? We all have to bring something extra in this hyper-connected world. We all have to really become residents of Garrison Keillor's fictional Lake Wobegon, where all the men are strong, all the women are good-looking, and all the children are above average. Because, my friends, in this hyper-connected world, average is officially over.
Pluval je Thomas Friedman, pomagal je Lan, slišmo in slinmo se čez en mesec.
Kratite, zvonov milozvočje dušite.